Good evening and welcome to The Laundry List on 90.5 FM CFCR. You just heard the Tony K Trio with...
Boredom is the devil's tool.
Boredom is the devil's tool. That's catchy. I like it. And with me this evening is my colleague and friend, Julie Kay. And we're going to be talking a little bit about her return to Saskatoon and what got her back here and why she's back and her research on human trafficking in Canada, which is fascinating. And she's been working on this issue for quite some time. And she also has a book coming out about the same topic that I'm really excited about, and I'm sure she's really excited about, because since we've known each other for the last few years, we've been keeping track with each other and encouraging each other when it felt like, you know, we didn't want to continue with down the book route. So welcome, Julie. Welcome to The Laundry List.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So tell the listeners a little bit about you and... you know, we met in Saskatoon, but you left us,
yes,
and at the time did not know temporarily, but you're back. So what brings you running back to Saskatoon, Julie?
We had a hard time leaving. So while we were away, we've always been hoping to possibly get back. And so we're really glad to be back. I've just started at the university, a position in sociology.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I'm thrilled. It's a great department, and I'm looking forward to getting settled in there.
Great. So what you were here for your PhD research, and what was your research on, and who did you work with while you were here?
So I was looking at responses to trafficking at the time, and so I did my field work in Vancouver, in Winnipeg and Calgary. So That's why even when we were here, I was traveling quite a bit while I was doing that research. But that was what my dissertation was on. And then I've since taken kind of a new approach to that research in this book that I've been working on. So I was working with patients Elabora de Mudia as my doctoral supervisor.
So when you say human trafficking, what do you mean?
That's a good question.
and a hard one, I'm sure, to
answer.
Yeah,
so I take a fairly critical response to trafficking, in part because, not because it's not important and not because there aren't some really horrific experiences that warrant attention in their own right, but because the language and the way trafficking and the resources that have gone behind trafficking in large ways have, in my estimation, have been used to reproduce some of the problems that create trafficking in the first place. So we've not been addressing some of the real issues that can lead to this type of experience, but more, you know, placing Band-Aid responses onto it, which do get a lot of attention. They have all the sensationalism behind them, but aren't necessarily addressing the problems that we're seeing.
So when you say trafficking, like, there's been a lot of stories in the news about people, like, is it people being taken against their will? Is it sex slavery? Like, is it mostly a problem that affects women or different ethnicities or genders or...
Yeah, so trafficking, it really depends whose definition you're looking at. So the United Nations came up with a definition. Canada has adopted a definition into our criminal code. We also have a definition in our Immigration and Refugee Protection Act. And all those definitions have slight differences. But the key element of them is that there's some form of exploitation or coercion. So it's really debated what trafficking actually is. But so on the one end, some people have... taken trafficking to be all forms of working in sex industries, and on the other end of it, it should encompass all sorts of different types of labor, like working. There can be forms of exploitation within multiple industries. The construction industry, we've seen cases in the welding industry, in restaurant industries, hotels, live-in caregivers, you know, and so it should be this broader thing. And there's a lot of debates within that still.
So when I think, well, I'm guessing the common sort of understanding of trafficking or like slavery would be that's a problem that happens elsewhere. So is there a problem in Canada? And if there is, what's the scope? And I'm guessing the numbers are probably hard to come by because a lot of people maybe aren't being recorded when they are being trafficked, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that is true. But at the same time, and this is where I think we need to shift our focus a bit, is, you know, when we focus on trafficking, oftentimes, especially from a criminal justice standpoint, they're focusing on sort of this quite horrific, stereotypic case of, of what people might identify as trafficking. So things like even the use of the word slavery, in a sense, is a bit misleading, because the types of situations that we're talking about actually are more rooted in some of our own systems and structures and policies, right? So things like the temporary migrant worker program. Now, not saying that the all of that is trafficking. However, the precarious status that migrants have to live with creates a context where exploitation can occur, right? And so rather than focusing on how we create precarity or how we create experiences where people are, you know, we often use the terms at risk, right? And I see this all the time with Indigenous youth. You know, they're at risk of trafficking, or they're at risk of, you know, whatever it is we're looking at. But we're not looking at the structures and the context that's placed them at risk, right? And so things like ongoing forms of colonialism and abuse that they face on a day-to-day basis in our society that creates that risk, instead we're focused on them as being at risk. And it's the same with migrants. We focus on migrants as at risk of being trafficked, when instead of looking at, well, why is it that, where is that precarious status coming from? And really it's rooted in our own policies.
So when you say, like, colonialism or neo-colonialism, like, how, in what ways does that make people more, I don't know, susceptible for to trafficking of any sort?
Well, I think it makes people susceptible to the ways we respond to trafficking in some ways. So, for instance, the predominant response to trafficking has been from sort of a criminal justice type framework, you know, that we have these laws in place, we need to enforce the laws. But oftentimes, these types of laws can disproportionately affect people who are living with ongoing forms of colonialism. So the way Indigenous people are treated before the law within the criminal justice system by police, by law enforcement, can mean that they're disproportionately targeted by the mechanisms that we're saying are supposed to help them as being at risk. So to give you an example of that, not too long ago, Public Safety Canada issued, you know, a call for research, a call for proposals that said, you know, we want to look at how Indigenous families are trafficking their children. Well, it's not to say that there might not be some cases that could be identified within that, but it's really problematic to focus on, you know, Indigenous people as, you know, as the problem, and with no reference to any context of colonialism, racism that is experienced within the communities, and ways that they're just, you know, we already have all these legacies of apprehension and being policed and being removed from the house as not capable of caring for Indigenous children, and seen as, you know, all the history of residential schools. It's not to suggest that it's the same as residential schools, but there's another narrative going on today that still revolves around that colonial narrative of removing Indigenous people from their communities, and rather than addressing why those communities have become at risk, things like access to water, things like poverty, things like inadequate funding for First Nations children versus it being their community, an internal problem within the community, and that would sort of be our, you know, rescue oriented imperative that we would want to go in and fix that problem.
So, okay, let's take a step back, and maybe you could talk a little bit about when this became, like, on the radar in Canada, because it sounds like to me your research is primarily focused on Indigenous trafficking of Indigenous people in Canada, I guess maybe I'd like to know a little bit more about, I mean, are the same challenges in place for other people that are trafficked within Canada, or are there specific issues that need to be addressed within, like, that particular community?
So my book focuses on how responses to trafficking are reproducing some of the inequalities we see within Canada. So how it's reproducing both national gender and other forms of inequality through mm-hmm. these responses to trafficking. So trafficking kind of, I mean, it's interesting because when I first started this work, I used to always get asked, you know, we have trafficking in Canada.
Right, yeah. Because I think it would be shocking to a lot of people even now.
Yeah. But now a lot of times the response I get is, oh yeah, we have trafficking in Canada. Let me tell you all about it. And people tell me, you know, all the things that they know about trafficking. And oftentimes it does align with some of the quite sensationalistic awareness raising initiatives that, you know, have largely come from, you know, it's one of those things that has really brought together an interesting merger between, you know, like a very conservative right mm-hmm. and a radical feminist kind of coalition in a sense or overlap, where typically they would disagree on a lot of things, but on this realm of trafficking there seems to be some uncomfortable agreements.
Okay, interesting. Let me probe that a bit. Yeah. So there's some common ground between conservatives and radical feminists. Do tell.
Yeah, and so that revolves a lot around the relationship between trafficking and sex work, right?
Right.
And so this unifying of and this attempt to conflate trafficking with all forms of prostitution or all forms of sexualized mm-hmm. labor has united those two agendas because, you know, as you can imagine, conservatives are quite opposed to sex industries and mm-hmm. And radical feminists have also really advocated as all forms of prostitution being a type of oppression.
Right.
Whereas others and then they've sort of demonized this other group that would be searching for sex worker rights or these kinds of things. And they call them the pro-pimp lobby or the pro-prostitution lobby, which there's a lot of this really awful rhetoric that goes mm-hmm. around that misses a lot of the nuance of where people are really coming from. Mm-hmm. And the goal of, you know, most sex worker rights advocates, you know, certainly there are those who have found empowerment and who have really, you know, would advocate for their profession. Mm-hmm. But within that, there's also a whole other group of people who realize that that there has been, you know, forms of exploitation. There has been violence, disproportionate violence that have been experienced by sex workers. But rather than view it that all as oppression, the idea is to try to increase the rights of people working in sex industries and make sure that they have access to things like safety and mm-hmm. And that they're not disproportionately targeted by police through that sort of prohibition or oppression type paradigm.
So now that this is on the radar, like there's more attention being given to the fact that A, this is happening in Canada, and B, you know, the obvious question is like, okay, so what? So what do we do about it now? So now that there's been some, you know, numbers behind this unfortunate phenomena, what is being done in Canada that you are seeing having actual positive results?
Yeah.
Are there any things that are having positive results? And what does that even mean, right?
Well, it's a good question, because what I see as having some of the most positive results are the things that are not falling within the trafficking paradigm, which is quite shocking. Like, so people who have been working for a long time within with migrant sex workers, for example. So migrant sex workers initially were the now I think attention has shifted a bit more to Indigenous sex workers, but mm-hmm. migrant sex workers were initially those deemed who are most vulnerable of trafficking.
Right.
And so what we saw is, you know, people who had been working for a long time with migrant sex workers, as soon as this trafficking paradigm came about, well, they didn't get included in any of the funding or resources for responding to trafficking. Rather, they in a lot of ways got defunded, while other agencies were getting funded who took more of a, like, trying to abolish or exit or end all forms of sexualized labor. And so those who continue to work, you know, I think of Swan in Vancouver. They, you know, they take a harm reduction approach. They go, they have great relationships with the sex working community. They, you know, and yet when, so they and the sex working community potentially could have been seen as a good place to identify trafficking, but because they're all seen as oppressed, they weren't recognized as being worthy of funding and resourcing. And so and there's others in Toronto and in other places who are creating a lot of coalitions or solidarities, I guess is a better word, between, you know, migrant and Indigenous and other racialized sex workers, gendered experiences where realizing that there are certain levels of harms that they faced from the criminal justice system, that they faced from the policing and from that sort of response to their experiences, their bodies, mm-hmm. that has been quite oppressive. And so they're creating solidarities to try to find safety among each other. And so that's something I've been involved in Edmonton, is working with the sex working community to identify places of peer support. What mm-hmm. in what ways can are sex workers already supporting themselves, and in what ways can those be better resourced so that safety can be created among the communities who are so-called at risk versus policing their bodies further in the name of safety.
Right. Well, we're not policing your thoughts, because we are the laundry list on 90.5 FM CFCR. And tonight, Lisa, that's me, I'm talking to Julie Kay about trafficking in Canada. And she's telling us all these really interesting, troubling, but promising dynamics that are happening right now. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, Julie, but we got to plug. Got to plug the show and the station. So, okay. So, and we're just talking a little bit about coalitions, harm reduction, and some of the initiatives that are happening across Canada. And it sounds like people, I think one of the things that people would be interested in is, okay, so the people that are actually trafficked or have been trafficked, what has their response been like, to bring out like a subjective narrative to this? Because you're saying people are getting together, working together in the sex trade or sex work. So like, what are the voices of, where are those voices of the people that have been trafficked and victims of this?
Yeah. So again, there's no unified narrative, right? And so we do see some voices have really identified with the trafficking narrative, that they feel that they were significantly oppressed and that their experience falls into that trafficked narrative, that their experience of the sex trade was that it is a form of oppression and trafficking. And so you see sort of and I would never discount any person's lived experience, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone has these lived experiences that are subjective. And so I'm not in any way here to discount mm-hmm. or to elevate one person's experience over another. However, within some of the trafficking awareness, we've seen the pedestaling of certain narratives where, I have in my own research, I've found narratives of women who've been, put on some of these awareness circuits where they're, told to tell their story and from that oppressive framework. And some of them feel like they were, some of them overtly were told they had to lie about their experience. Like they had to tell their story and tell their experience in a certain way to fit in with a particular narrative.
And what is that narrative?
That
they're trying to fit into.
That all of the sex trade and all of that is oppressive.
So
and
it's a victim.
It's a victim-based narrative. Right. Yeah. Now, there are people who have been extraordinarily victimized who identify with that narrative, and I'm not wanting to speak over those voices. They have mm-hmm. their experience, and they have every right to share their experience. And what part of this work is about is recognizing that is one person's experience. Mm-hmm. We also have all numbers of other people, like Indigenous persons in the sex industry, on both ends of that spectrum. Mm-hmm. Like there's some who have experienced it as exploitation, others who've experienced it as a form of both exploitation and empowerment, others who have experience it more as empowerment. So there's a spectrum of experiences, mm-hmm. and we need to grow increasingly comfortable that there is a spectrum of how we respond to these things. Mm-hmm. But the ultimate goal is that we're not further creating harms in the responses that we have. So if in the sex industries, what we're hearing is that, a prohibition framework is leading to increasing policing, increasing violence, increasing insecurity, then that's a problem, mm-hmm. right? And so that's where the goal is, to work with people who are currently living in it, not only people who have already exited, but also working with people who have that experience as well, to understand, what was your experience? But realizing that's not everybody's same lived experience.
Right. So just from my, geeky political science brain, okay, so the range and, you know, levels of experience are, you know, they're varied. We have to respect people's subjectives, understanding of their own experiences. Absolutely. I see that being a major challenge as a researcher, especially when you're trying to kind of essentialize something and trying to tell a story, mm-hmm. Like create your own narrative, but not an overly simplistic narrative. So I would like to hear what you have to say about that, like how that's challenging to sort of avoid create, like building a narrative. And when I'm assuming policymakers have contacted you and asked you because you're a leader in this field of research. Okay, because policy, from what I know of policymakers, they want simple solutions. They want to know what should we do. Mm-hmm. So if the problem's not simple, the experiences are not unified, and the demand is for a simple, unified answer, what position does that put you as a researcher in? Because you're in a way you are representing these people's experiences to the policymakers, right?
Yeah. So it's a interesting dynamic, I guess I would say, is, you know, I think I went into this work wanting to find ways to depoliticize it. Mm-hmm. That was kind of one of my ongoing narratives. I have a background in researching peace building and peacekeeping. And so I was interested in ways that things like that are so hotly political could be depoliticized. And quite quickly, I came to realize that actually things are oftentimes politicized for a reason, and that this is a very politicized area for a lot of reasons. And one of the main reasons is that people's lives are at stake, right? Yeah. And people are fighting for their lives. And so it isn't something that can be approached in any way lightly, for mm-hmm. one. But when I'm talking to policymakers, you know, part of my contention is that the way we've done policy and the way we do policy is reproducing the problems that we see, and we're not addressing the way our laws and our policies are rooted in a colonial narrative that continues to reproduce mm-hmm. itself. Mm-hmm. And so, what I am pushing for is that we start to take that complexity into account in developing some of those things, and that we start to actually deal with things like Indigenous self-determination mm-hmm. in multiple forms of policy areas. It can't just mm-hmm. be, you know, these like
the criminal justice system.
Right, exactly. But that we're looking at it more broadly speaking. And so in things like trafficking, it's one area that's been quite problematic for reproducing those problems. And so that's what I look at, but I wouldn't suggest that it's the only area. I'm sure there's others, and, mm-hmm. and others are looking at that in very interesting ways as well.
Okay. Well, we're winding down in time. It's insane. I can't even believe it, but okay. I'll just get you to comment on like two things. And then I want to leave like a minute or so at the end just to make a little announcement. But okay, so what would be your top three recommendations to policymakers from your perspective in a general sense? I'm guessing, like most things, building flexibility into new regulatory frameworks. I mean, that's, geez, mm-hmm. that's like the answer for everything, right? Because that responds to diversity of and allows for policy to be more flexible in response. And like, yeah, anyways, I'll let you talk instead of me answer your question that I just asked you. So what would be your top three in like as succinct way as possible, which I know is not fair, but go ahead.
Yeah, so I don't know if I have a top three, but I would say
top two.
I increasingly would like to see policymakers feel uncomfortable. You know, policymakers often will come to the table wanting it to be a comfortable experience and wanting consultation to be checking some boxes to get the responses that they were looking for in a fairly neat narrative. And so I've been to a number of these so-called consultations where I see the policymakers really trying to fit very complex narratives into the boxes they've already come into the table with, mm-hmm. and them not quite fitting. And so what I'd like is for policymakers to engage more than just consult. So rather than coming to the table with all their ideas sorted out and looking for confirmation, you know, I'd really like to see policymakers engage in a way that they learn those responses and they learn from the communities that they're supposedly consulting mm-hmm. with. And that's going to be an extremely uncomfortable process, and mm-hmm. and it shouldn't be comfortable because we live in very uncomfortable political times.
Don't I know it? It's hard to watch the news these days. Yeah. Absolutely. I think that's a really good, a good suggestion. Like many things instead of giving people advice and telling them what to do, why don't you ask people what they need? Mm-hmm. Like, that seems to be, you know, if you want to help people, then you have to ask people, those people, yeah, what they need.
And you have to be prepared that their experiences might not fit into anything
exactly
that you've been frameworking or yeah, putting together, you know, in your fairly comfortable office spaces.
Yeah, yeah, in your privileged position, right? Like,
that's right.
And by the time we are adults, we usually get some pretty strong worldviews going on, and it's mm-hmm, hard to have those confronted with reality.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, our job as academics, I hope, is yeah, to, you know, deal with it. Thank you so much for coming in this evening, Julie. It was great talking to you, and I hope, you know, I hope the listeners, it gave you, our conversation gave you lots to think about. And I'm going to put up some, if Julie has some resources that people would like to know more about this issue in Canada and abroad, I will put some links up on our Facebook page. But in the minute remaining, I just wanted to mention that I thank you everyone for coming out to the Girls Rock Camp Saskatoon showcase on Saturday. It was a great time. Tear, you know, no dry eyes in the house. But if you missed the showcase, don't even worry about it, because there's Girls Rock Camp Saskatoon showcase number 2 next Saturday, July 16th at the Broadway Theater. And I encourage you all to go, whether you know or have a child in the Girls Rock program. It will, in our very uncertain times that are full of really bad news and, you know, bad things happening, it actually makes you feel kind of good inside and maybe, you know, knock some ice off the heart. So anyways, you've been listening to The Laundry List on 90.5 CFCR. You've been listening to Lisa and with me, Julie Kay. And thank you very much, Julie. Good night.
Good night.